In some ways, I thought it was the best answer he could have given. You had to give him points for honesty. They walked away, Huddy and Ned, heading toward the Bel Air. Eddie split apart from them, going toward his own car and pausing long enough at mine to take the Kojak light off the roof and toss it inside. Ned stopped at the rear bumper of his car and turned back to me. "Sandy?"
"What is it?"
"Didn't he have any idea at all about where it came from? What it was? Didn't any of you?"
"No. We'd blue-skied it from time to time, but no one ever had an idea that felt like the real deal, or even close.
Jackie O'Hara probably nailed it when he said the Buick is like a jigsaw piece that won't fit into the puzzle anywhere. You worry it, and you turn it this way and that, try it everywhere. And one day you turn it over and see the back is red, and the backs of all the pieces in your puzzle are green. Do you follow that?"
"No," he said.
"Well, think about it," I said, "because you're going to have to live with it."
"How am I supposed to do that?"
There was no anger in his voice. The anger had been burned away. Now all he wanted was instructions.
"Good.
You don't know where you came from or where you're going, do you?" I asked him. "But you live with it just the same. Don't rail against it too much. Don't spend more than an hour a day shaking your fists at the sky and cursing God."
"But..."
"There are Buicks everywhere," I said. Steph came out after they were gone and offered me a cup of coffee. I told her, thanks, but I'd pass.
I asked her if she had a cigarette. She gave me a prim look, almost shocked, and reminded me she didn't smoke,
as though that was her toll booth, one with the sign reading, "All Buick Roadmasters must detour beyond this point." Man, if we lived in that world. If only.
"Are you going home?" she asked.
"Shortly."
She went inside. I sat by myself on the smoker's bench. There were cigarettes in my car, at least a half a pack in the glove box, but getting up seemed like too much work, at least for the moment. When I did get up, I reckoned it would be best just to stay in motion. I could have a smoke on the way home and a TV dinner when I got in. The country way would be closed by now, and I doubted Cynthia Garris would be very happy to see my face in the place again soon anyway. I'd given her a pretty good scare earlier. Her fright nothing to mine when the penny finally dropped and I realized what Ned was almost certainly planning to do. And my fear then was only a shadow of the terror I'd felt as I'd looked into that rising purple glare with the boy hanging blind in my arms and that steady beat, beat, beat in my ears, a sound like approaching footfalls. I had been looking both down, as if into a well, and on an up-tilted plane, as if my vision had been split by some prismatic device. It had been like looking through a periscope lined with lightning. What I saw was very vivid. I'll never forget it. And fabulously strange. Yellow grass, brownish at the tips, covered a rocky slope that rose before me and then broke off at the edge of a drop. Green-backed beetles bustled in the grass, and off to one side there grew a clump of those waxy lilies. I hadn't been able to see the bottom of the drop, but I could see the sky. It was a terrible, engorged purple, packed with clouds and ripe with lightning. A prehistoric sky. In it, circling in ragged flocks, were flying things, birds maybe, or bats like the one Kurt had tried to dissect. They were too far away for me to be sure, and all this happened very quickly, remember. I think there was an ocean at the foot of that drop, but I don't know why I think it, perhaps only because of the fish that came bursting out of the Buick's trunk that time, or the smell of salt. Around the Roadmaster there was always that vague, teary smell of salt.